Next presentation by Dr. John Lehman. It is the fertilizers and the sustainability of subsistence agriculture in developing countries. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Bala, and thank you for organizing this session. I want to share a few thoughts on nutrient cycles and what we can and maybe not cannot do. This is a familiar graph about the yield gap, and it shows that there's vast areas in the world that show suboptimal yields, particularly in the low latitudes and around in West Africa, East Africa, and Asia and Central America. A lot of this yield gap seems to be a result of nutrient limitation. And nutrient and irrigation or water limitations. A common response at the moment seems to be to veer towards a package of solutions that's called conservation agriculture, and invariably that entails a lot of different things and means different things to different people. So it's very hard or impossible to make generalizations. Here's some data from one of our projects in Zambia, where conservation farming, under the term conservation farming, has been developed for a couple decades now, and quite effectively promoted. This type of conservation agriculture entails digging small pits, putting organic matter, some nutrients into these pits or planting stations that are hopefully and supposedly preserved from season to season. We did a study initially starting with several hundred farmers that were reduced over time to about 200 farmers, and for certain comparisons a few less. And you see here for different agroecological zones, from the drier areas in Zambia to the wetter areas in Zambia, we didn't really find any yield improvements for corn using this type of conservation agriculture. There were a few areas, especially on the drier parts, that you could see a marginal increase, although it was significant statistically. I would say it wasn't necessarily relevant, although that's definitely a debate among food security specialists, what is a relevant increase and what not. When the story changed quite significantly is when we started putting more resources in. Here, this is the same set of experiments with an expanded database, and you see here with the addition of Glyricidia, we didn't quite see a yield increase. With manure, we saw, especially in the drier areas, a almost doubling of crop yield. Still, a significant increase in the wetter and intermediate areas. But where there was really a large increase is when we added recommended fertilizers. So Glyricidia and manure as an approach to managing nutrients could be an approach, but is not always effective. In this case, with the Glyricidia, this is a legume, as you all know, but it didn't have a lot of nitrogen. So it can be in some areas that you have organic resources that should be effective but are not because they are of such poor quality. The same is observed very often in this area also for animal manures that are of such poor quality that they're actually pretty useless as an organic fertilizer. Fertilizers are, in terms of nutrient inputs, of course, transformative. So how can we make this more effective, or what are additional options to doing that? Oh, I wanted to share this before I move on. We looked at the connection between the soil properties and environmental properties of the sites that we did this study in, and you can clearly see that without nutrient inputs or just the normal compost input that the farmers use, we have somewhat a control of soil fertility related parameters, less so of elevation, curvature, and other location-specific attributes. That went away with fertilizer additions, and only texture and elevation remained as predictors. So the conventional solutions are adding plant animal composts as organic amendments to mitigate nutrient constraints, and of course import commercial fertilizers from outside farm gates, and very often in many countries also outside national boundaries. What else can we do? And I'll follow on here with some thoughts on the ideas that Bala presented in his talk. There are a lot of opportunities, I feel, that are not very easy, but possible to leverage from food processing, sanitation, and byproducts from bioenergy that are in the business realm, usually outside the farm gates, or recycling from households to fields, inside the farm gates, from kitchen to field, toilet to field, and stove residues to field. And we are not doing a good job in leveraging those. I'll give a couple of examples that we've been working on and trying to move forward. One is phosphorus recycling from animal residues, and obviously that's regionally very different. Here an example from Ethiopia, who have a very large herd and are a lot of pastoralists in Ethiopia. A rough calculation of the phosphorus resources in Ethiopia shows that there are about 17,000 to 36,000 tons of phosphorus being cycled through slaughtered animals per year. So these are high-level top-down calculations. That's about half or a little less than Ethiopia's annual phosphorus imports, worth about $50 to $100 million per year. So there's a lot of phosphorus cycling around, but of course, how do we get at that, and where is it? In rare cases, it's in a big heap. There are sources in a big heap that somebody wants to get rid of, and there are opportunities there, but most of it is actually going to other people that are consuming it, and it might be more difficult to get at these resources. So we looked from bottom up and looked at households, how many bone wastes would they have. This is done in four regions in Ethiopia, a little bit over 500 households, and looking at different scenarios of bone availability. We had to make assumptions about what kind of consumption they would have. But the upshot, no matter what we do, the upshot is that if we were to use this as a business, and they would need to rely on their internal phosphorus resources, we could only supply between 1 and 45% of their recommended phosphorus fertilizers per year. And high is probably a really high estimate and highly unrealistic. So it's more in this range here. So that's, of course, not great. We're contributing 1% of recommended fertilizers doesn't get us anywhere. And, of course, there's no surplus generated. So there's also no business opportunity to aggregate those and make a commercial product out of it. You can look at it a little bit differently and look at high value vegetable gardens and see how much you can actually supply fully with phosphorus. And you see here, these are probably areas that are quote-unquote kitchen gardens or high-value crop subsistence gardens that could be supplied fully with phosphorus recycled from bones, even under low estimates of phosphorus availability. So there are opportunities for these high-value crops, but definitely no opportunities for a commercial approach or satisfying the entire phosphorus needs. We looked a bit at the product itself. And at different bone products, bones and rendered bones, we like to experiment with heat treatment. And at high heat treatment, we can reach the available phosphorus contents that are in the range of a commercial triple superphosphate, or almost there, and well above a rock phosphate product. What does that look in terms of availability to the crop in an experiment? Here's a greenhouse experiment with soils, weathered soils, low pH soils from Ethiopia, looking at maize phosphorus uptake, and if I just direct you to the right side, we experimented with different varieties of maize with root hairs, without root hairs, and with Abascula mycorrhizae. But if we just look, if we just look at the right side, you'll see that there was no significant difference between phosphorus uptake where triple superphosphate was added or bone char was added. So there were statistically, although there was obviously a little bit of a trend, statistically not significantly different in supplying phosphorus to a maize crop. In preliminary one-year data that we need to confirm for multiple years, we did field experiments on farms in Ethiopia and found that we could substitute a considerable portion. These are percent of recommended by the Ministry of Agriculture, substitute significant portions of the triple superphosphate additions with bone char phosphorus and generated the same yield as with the recommended additions. So looking at this old diagram that Roland Buresh published many years ago about the relative costs and relative effectiveness of the different phosphorus sources, where he went away with saying that acidulated phosphate rock might be an option, a happy medium between keeping costs down and improving yields. And my question is now, where are the relative costs and the effectiveness in bone char? Effectiveness seems to be almost as good, if not the same as triple superphosphate, but where are the relative costs and can we get it? Here are some data from a survey, again from these four districts or woredas in Ethiopia, with about 500 observations, how much local farmers would be willing to pay for a organic fertilizer or for an alternative fertilizer. And these are Ethiopian birrs, and if you translate that into fertilizer prices, then it's about 10% of the current inorganic fertilizer prices. Obviously, that shows you that they are not willing to put a lot of money down, but they also don't know a lot about it. So they have never seen it. So this is just a sort of a baseline scenario. For just a few farmers, and we're just starting with that, we're looking at what was their perception before and after they had experimented with it. On the left side is we asked them before they had experience with it, and on the right side after they had experience with it. The left side sort of mirrors what I just said from this much larger data set, that they said, well, we won't pay you anything for it, or we pay you rock bottom for it. But after they had experience with it and realized, well, I'm getting almost as much or as much yield with this fertilizer as I used to get, or as I get when I put TSP on, there was a quite relevant shift to the right side, and nobody said, I don't pay you anything, everybody wanted to put some money down, and it shifted a bit to the right. So those are some hopeful trends, and obviously these data sets are yet too meager to jump to any greater conclusions. Let me shift for a couple minutes to nitrogen recycling. Another project that we're interested in, and again, following very nicely on Bala's comments, what do we do with all our human excrements? This is a project in the slums of Nairobi, where Sanergy and the Climate Foundation are building toilets. These are separating toilets where urine and feces are separated, and we're trying to figure out what we can do with that to get to make a fertilizer out of it that can be recycled to farms. And there's quite a lot of nitrogen in these latrines. There are about 200,000 people in Kibera, and this one slum, which is arguably the largest slum in sub-Saharan Africa, 50 tons of wet waste and 200,000 liters of urine that generate 300 tons of nitrogen per year. That would supply 3,700 farms with 90 kilograms of nitrogen per year, which is the recommended rate for maize fertilization. So those are significant amounts that we should be able to recycle. The question is, and finding these business models is really the trick. So finding franchise models that generate business opportunities for landless poor that can engage in these activities is really key for this bottom-up approach. So in conclusion, I think there are still more opportunities than just shifting biomass from one field to the other within the farm gate, but including households more aggressively within the farm, but it will not save the day. We need to recycle from outside the farm gate, and that will not happen without smart technology development and business development on a very small scale, and that really needs still quite a bit of thought. Thank you very much.
Any questions? Please?
Yeah, in the back there.
Just going back to the last section about Sanergy and the toilets. I come from Kenya and I really understand that concept. My worry is with the urine based fertilizer, what about the sodium level? Because I'm assuming it would be very high. How would you deal with that?
Yeah, the sodium levels, it depends on the technology that will be used. There's some groups in this consortium working on struvite precipitation. That seems to be what many people work on, and that might be viable with some separation techniques. Obviously, there's no way that you would apply the urine as such for a whole host of reasons. One mundane one is that you can't even transport that much liquid around the landscape, let alone handle it. We are trying to look at some adsorption and other precipitation techniques where we would naturally not precipitate the sodium out, so it would just leave in the wastewater. Yeah, but that's a good thing to watch out for.
No more questions. Thank you. One more.
If we have time, I'll take one more. Yeah.
Okay. I was just wondering, in the areas where bone char was being looked at, are those areas also fuel limited, and are people looking at how the heat treatment needed would be produced? And I would imagine that heat treatment would be another possibility in some of the human waste.
Yeah. No, that's a good question, and That's certainly an obstacle. We have not worked on the middle part, on the engineering part. We've only worked on the front end, finding business model, how to collect it and how much is there, and then the back end, the willingness to pay, as well as the agronomic efficiency. The engineering part in the middle is what's the bottleneck in all of this, because it costs a lot more money. Social scientists are usually happy with a computer. Agronomists need a little bit more. But the middle part of the technology development, that's usually the costly part. And you're absolutely right. There will be discussions, where do you take the heat from? Because there's not a lot of heat in the, or energy in the bones. You need to supply heat. Yeah, that's a bottleneck. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.